Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to be a patriot? For decades, Colonel Anne Wright served her country officially, first in the Army and later in the Foreign Service, in places as far-flung as Afghanistan, Micronesia, and Sierra Leone. But in 2003, she wrote a long letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell to say she could no longer work for a government whose actions included invading Iraq without UN approval and without time for weapons inspectors to fully investigate the WMD threat. She was the highest-ranking U.S. official to publicly resign in protest of the war. Since then, Wright has been a fearless critic of the Bush administration's defense strategies and foreign policy. She has been arrested 5 times and banned from 2 military bases and the Washington Press Club. She's in town tonight for an address at Fun Asia in Richardson to the Dallas Peace Center that takes place at 6 o'clock. And she has also just written a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. And welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here in Dallas and KERA.
Can you talk about what went into your decision to resign? You had decades of passionate work for the federal government under your belt.
Indeed. I'd worked for 8 different presidents, starting with Lyndon Johnson back during an unpopular war, the Vietnam War. I had been in government through many administrations where there are a lot of policies that the people of America were disturbed about, but I stayed in government. And it was the decision of the Bush administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States and had nothing to do with the events of 9/11 that I felt that I could no longer represent the policies of this administration, because I felt the going to war with the Iraqis over the issues of weapons of mass destruction was wrong, that we needed, if indeed there was such strong evidence of weapons of mass destruction, then the UN Security Council would have voted for an international military approach to Iraq, similar to what happened during Gulf War I. When the UN Security Council voted to use the forces of the international community to push Saddam Hussein out of a country he had invaded, Kuwait.
Did you realize at the time that you would be so alone in deciding to leave the Foreign Service and the federal government?
Well, there were 3 of us that resigned from the federal government, and it happened that all 3 of us were from the diplomatic corps. None of us, the 3 of us, knew each other from before. We each independently resigned. We've become good friends since then. And it wasn't like it was just the 3 of us resigning. There were lots and lots of people in our federal government, but both in the diplomatic corps and in the military, that knew the invasion and occupation of Iraq was going to be a very problematic policy for the administration. And in fact, in the days right after I resigned, I received over 400 emails from colleagues in the diplomatic corps assigned to U.S. embassies all over the world saying, this policy, this invasion is going to wreck the U.S. reputation in the world. That already we're seeing, and this was before the invasion happened, already we're seeing demonstrations all over the world against the U.S. Going into Iraq. And it wasn't like it was just the 3 of us. There was I fully believe that there was a real gut instinct in most government employees that this was not going to turn out very well.
So when you're really disturbed by something within any kind of organization, there are a couple of ways to go, one of which is to leave and the other is to stay and try to effect change from a position of relative power. Why not do that?
Well, indeed. And as it turns out, that's the way most people approached it that were in the government. There were only 3 of us that chose the route of resigning. And I certainly appreciate that fact, too, because if everyone who was concerned about every single policy quit every time a policy came up, we would have very little continuity in our government. And indeed, administrations kind of rely on career government employees, civilian employees, and our military, being a professional military, it does not change as administrations change. So you need a continuity. However, I would say that I think a lot of people who remained in the government to work to try to ameliorate, soften, maybe level out the ups and downs of policies of every administration, that for those who stayed in the Bush administration, I think it's been a very, very difficult time, morally challenging time, and I would say many of them probably have ulcers.
You hung on to the letter that you wrote. This was not something you dashed off in a fever of passion. You hung on to that for weeks, hoping that you wouldn't have to send it.
Well, indeed. I kept hoping that the pressure the administration was putting on Iraq of military buildup in the region, but not using that military, but maybe that would the buildup would force Saddam to do something that would satisfy the international community, or particularly the United States, and to give more time for those UN weapons inspectors, many of whom were U.S. citizens on this inspection team, to go in and keep digging around to see if they could find any of these weapons of mass destruction. You know, it was mystifying to me how in the world, after 12 years of two no-fly zones, of essentially sanctions on the country of Iraq, very stiff sanctions, U.S. surveillance, spy planes covering all of Iraq, people watching the borders of Iraq. How in the world could that weapons program have continued? How could it be hidden? I mean, there were inspections for 6 years after Gulf War I. It mystified me where this idea that there were still lots of weapons of mass destruction were. But I felt, well, we ought to at least try to find them rather than invading the country. We ought to at least give the UN inspectors more time to try to find them.
Retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright is my guest. She was also in the U.S. Foreign Service for 16 years. She resigned in 2003 in protest of the Iraq War and other Bush administration policies. What sort of response did you have, if any, from Secretary Powell?
Well, I got a very short cable back from him, from my very lengthy letter of resignation. My letter was about 3.5 pages long, and I felt it. I could at least give one page for every decade I'd been in government service. So it was a lengthy one. I mentioned not only, of course, the pending war in Iraq, but also mentioned what I felt were the lack of the administration in trying to resolve the issues that were going on in other places in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And if you remember back in 2003, I mean, that area right in there was aflame. There were Palestinian suicide bombers that were blowing up cafes. Then the response from the Israelis was to bulldoze Palestinian villages. And I felt the Bush administration needed to use its power and leverage to calm that situation down and to start working on a plan to help ultimately resolve the issues so that there can be peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, which I think is a great source of the instability of the Middle East.
What's your take on the recent efforts by the Bush administration to sort of go back in and try to do this at the 11th hour, many people think?
Well, I think it's an attempt to salvage some sort of legacy. I certainly think it should have happened in the first administration, in the first years of the first administration. And in the same manner, the contact with North Korea. If you remember back in 2003, the Bush administration was still saying, we're going to study the problem of North Korea. They weren't about to touch anything that was done during the Clinton administration. But it took the North Koreans kind of lashing out at the international community, of accosting vessels at sea, of sending missiles over Japan, ultimately of blowing up something, of exploding a bomb. When we still, as far as I know, we aren't quite sure what it was, but it was something big enough that it got the attention of the administration to first start participating in multilateral talks and later in bilateral talks. And as we see now, that there has been major movement with the North Koreans on their stopping their nuclear program in exchange for food aid and for other types of aid. And I would say that that was something that the administration would have been wise to do on the Palestinian-Israeli issues early in the administration, and in the same manner, in the other very dangerous situation that we have in the Middle East is pertaining to another one of the axis of evil countries, Iran, that indeed I firmly believe that we must pursue active, strong diplomacy in order to resolve the issues that we have with Iran. And slowly, despite very heated rhetoric, the administration is doing some things that indicate a more diplomatic approach to include at least rumors that they're talking about perhaps reopening diplomatic relations with Iran.
One of the things that you wrote about in your resignation letter in 2003 is so prescient that it's chilling. You said if we put U.S. troops in Iraq, there will be an uptick in violence. There will be lives lost, American lives and Iraqi lives, and it was something that you were concerned about even then. Now, obviously, we know that's exactly what happened. But clearly, you weren't the only person of your rank and your stature who understood that this was a possibility. Why do you think other people didn't speak up at the time?
Well, I think there was a bit of dialogue going on behind the scenes, but it was being squashed pretty strongly within the hierarchy of both the State Department and the Department of Defense. I think anybody that's been in diplomacy for any period of time, and they don't really necessarily have to be assigned to a Middle Eastern country, that they can pretty well figure out that if you invade and occupy a country that has not done anything to the United States, and there is a history of U.S. involvement there to include putting sanctions on the country, no fly zones over it. I mean, America was not beloved for really putting the squeeze on the people of Iraq to the extent that the estimates are that some 500,000 children may have died during the period of the sanctions after Gulf War I in the latter days of the Bush 1 administration and through the Clinton administration.
Because of lack of food and medicine and other
and
supplies.
And medicines, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though there was supposedly this oil for food program, there still was a real those sanctions programs really hurt the wrong people. They hurt the children, the vulnerable. They're supposed to be used. I mean, the theory is, if you put enough squeeze on the little people, then they'll riot and they'll cause trouble for the big people that you're really trying to get to effect changes. But indeed, what happens is that many of those people die under sanctions that the United States sponsors. And that's why a lot of people right now in Washington are protesting against the latest piece of legislation, which would authorize a much stronger sanctions program against Iran, and indeed almost a blockade of Iran by some people's estimate. So there are a lot of people in Washington right now that are protesting it, in fact, putting blockades around some of the congressional offices of those people that are sponsoring legislation and putting a naval blockade around the houseboat of one of the congressmen that lives out on a houseboat on the Potomac River. And Code Pink Women for Peace had their naval armada out there to show Congressman Ackerman, you know, that the blockades, their point was that, you know, blockades harm the wrong people.
Code Pink is a group that you've worked with a lot. And one of the things that happens occasionally is that you will be arrested or some member of the group will be arrested. Can you talk about the first time that happened? You who had this long career of government service, the first time that they actually put you in jail?
Well, the first time I was ever arrested was in September of 2005, and I was arrested along with 400 other people for refusing to get up off the sidewalk in front of the White House. There had been over 1,500 people that had been in front of the White House after 2 days previously, several hundred thousand, probably 500,000 people had marched in Washington against the war, and I was one of 400, and it scared the fire out of me. I mean, as a government employee, I'd never been arrested, and I didn't know what to expect. It's not a pleasant process at all to be arrested and then be in jail and then go to court for it. But it's important, I think, as civil disobedience against policies that you would disagree with.
And that was just the beginning. We'll hear more from retired Colonel Anne Wright in just a moment. Her book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience. She's in town to appear at a Fun Asia in Richardson event. It is sponsored by the Dallas Peace Center. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is peace activist, retired Colonel Anne Wright. She also spent 16 years in the U.S. Foreign Service. Her new book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. She's in town for a Dallas Peace Center address tonight at 6. You can find information about that at dallaspeacecenter.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. What was your perception, Anne, of protesters during the years that you did serve in the military and that you did serve in the Foreign Service? You were in the Army during Vietnam.
Indeed. And my first assignment was in at the Presidio of San Francisco, right in the middle of some of the biggest anti-war protests that the United States had. And I joined the Army to, like most kids do, it's not to go out and kill anybody or anything like that. It's to get the GI Bill, to learn maybe a skill other than shooting a weapon. And also for me, it was to escape. And it was to escape the state of Arkansas. I grew up in Arkansas. I had a great childhood, but I wanted to get out of Arkansas. And the Army recruiter came through town, joined the Army, see the world. Vietnam, no, you won't have to go. And as a woman, there were very few women other than Army nurses that went to Vietnam. So I'd seen a lot of protests, and even in the diplomatic corps, I'd seen protests of American citizens at various embassies where I was assigned. For example, my very first assignment in the diplomatic corps was in 1987 in Central America in Nicaragua. During the time of the Reagan policies of, it was right at the end of the funding of the Contras in Nicaragua, and there were a lot of Americans that were coming down to Nicaragua to say that the United States should not be funding a paramilitary force to overthrow the revolutionary government that was there. And so every week we would have 20, 30, 50 Americans that would be protesting out in front of the embassy. And then as a junior officer, I was one of those who was designated to listen to the stories of American citizens who had been there for several weeks, to invite them into the embassy and listen and record their stories and send their thoughts to Washington. And I came to appreciate very much the sincerity of Americans who take time out of their lives to travel all over the world to places where U.S. policies, no matter what administration it is, they may disagree with. But they take time to go see what's going on, and then they make their decision. And if they feel the policies need to be protested, they get right out in front of the U.S. embassy, right in the face of the U.S. diplomats, to let them know what they think about it.
Do you feel like you're listened to now by the people that you're protesting?
I think it's I think the Bush administration certainly does recognize, even though the vice president says, who cares if 70% of the American public thinks the war in Iraq needs to end? I do believe the administration understands that when we hit the streets, when we are marching in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, that it does have a bit of an effect on it. Unfortunately, it hasn't meant that the war has ended. It hasn't meant that torture had ended. It doesn't mean that Guantanamo's closed. It doesn't mean that we aren't now being listened to on eavesdropped in on our cell phones, or that the FBI. I mean, we've had such a curtailment of civil rights and civil liberties under this administration, now approved by the U.S. Congress by legislation, which is staggering to me, that we have had so many things that have happened that were illegal, criminal acts committed by this administration, and then the Congress says, "Oh well, we'll give immunity to the corporations that were allowing the government to eavesdrop on us for 5 years when they knew it was illegal." And now the Congress says, "Oh well, we'll go ahead and now we'll pass a law saying it's okay." So I think the next administration, whichever one it is, I think I'll be protesting either one of them to roll back all of these curtailments of our civil liberties that have occurred in the last 7.5 years.
How do you plan your strategy, Anne? How do you decide, okay, I'm going to be in this city on this date. This will be my act of civil disobedience. What's the process like?
Well, it depends on what's happening. If there are congressional hearings that are going on that you feel you want to be in, that you want your presence to be known in, then you get a ticket and head on back to Washington, D.C., which is what I'll be doing tomorrow. Because on Friday, the House of Representatives, the House Judiciary Committee, will be having a hearing on what we hoped would be impeachment, but they're calling it something else, executive privilege, abuse of executive privilege, or something else like that. But it is Congressman Conyers and the House Judiciary Committee's acknowledgement that there is a huge amount of dissatisfaction in our country about the lack of accountability of this administration on the war in Iraq, on torture, on a variety of things that have already been identified in elements that could be used for hearings that could lead to the impeachment of senior officials of this administration. And because there's been so much pressure put on the House Judiciary Committee, they're finally holding a hearing on Friday. So I will be flying to Washington tomorrow, and I will get up early and get in line to hopefully grab one of the seats in the House Judiciary Committee to be able there to wear my Veterans for Peace shirt or my shirt that says Stop Torture. One of the things you have to have as an activist is a large suitcase to carry around all the T-shirts that you have for the various issues. This is not a one-issue campaign. This is a mini issue and a mini T-shirt campaign.
So you've also been arrested. In fact, once I believe at the House floor, you were taken out by yourself. And that's got to be a different situation from being among 400 people. And there's sort of a convivial atmosphere.
Indeed. I have been arrested a couple of times in congressional hearings. One of them was last September at the first Petraeus Crocker hearing. And I stood up after a friend of mine, Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He and I had served together in Afghanistan in 2002. And so I know Ryan very well. And he's a professional diplomat. He's one of our best Arabic linguists. He's been our ambassador to most of the countries in the Middle East. Prior to being ambassador to Iraq, he was ambassador to Pakistan. But I felt it was important that I stand up. He had given his version as a diplomat about the surge, and I felt, as a former diplomat, I wanted to have my say, saying that I don't believe you can get peace through occupation and that we need to end the occupation. Since I stood up and I said that, I had a T-shirt on that said that had the number of U.S. dead and then another piece of tape that had the number of Iraqis that have died during this conflict. And I stood up and said my piece. Since I was not an authorized witness, the chairman of the committee gaveled me, please sit down. But actually, when they gavel twice, that means you've been arrested. So here came Officer Tara of the Capitol Police up to my elbow to say, The chairman has gaveled you arrested, so I'll have to take you out of here.
She actually used your first name.
Oh, yeah. We know all the police. I mean, we see them many times, and many of them have arrested us at previous times. I now have been arrested actually 15 times.
15 times. Wow. Mm-hmm. So knowing this is coming, is your heart pounding? Is it pounding because you know you're about to stand up in front of all these people and shout something out and sort of interrupt when you've been raised in a culture, particularly a military culture, where there's a certain amount of obedience required?
Indeed. And you're exactly right. I mean, it is people don't do this with frivolity. It is a very serious thing when you stand up in a congressional hearing. You know that you are the possibilities are very high that you'll get arrested. And being arrested is not the point of the thing. It's the point is to be able to get perhaps a voice of that is not going to be heard at that committee hearing. And, you know, many people will say, well, they don't want to hear your voice or they would have invited you to be the witness, which is exactly the point, that indeed there are so many voices of our country that are not being heard, have never been heard in Congress. And the only way we have a chance to be heard is when we march in the streets, when we take the time to curtail our own freedom by standing up, knowing full well that we'll probably get put in jail because of it. But it's important to us, and I think most Americans would say, well, if they believe so strongly, you know, it's peaceful, nonviolent. All we're trying to do is to stop wars, to stop the killing, to stop an administration that is doing some criminal acts. That's all we're trying to do, is to stop those sorts of things. And it is a civic responsibility, I believe, when you feel that strongly about something, that you have to take action on it.
Former diplomat and retired U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright is my guest. Her new book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Randy in Richardson. Hi, Randy.
Hi, yeah. I want to first say I'd like to thank her for her courage standing up for those who don't and can't. My question is, to my understanding, we invaded Iraq, this administration invaded Iraq, to free those people and to give them democracy. I'd like to know her opinion on this administration's views on places like Burma. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Randy, thank you very much. Well, I think if we remember back to 2002 and 2003, bringing democracy to Iraq was not really one of the stated goals. It was to go after those weapons of mass destruction that were a danger to the United States and friends of the United States. And then when those weapons were not to be found anywhere, the rationale of why we were there moved to this thing called democracy. And then to your question of what about democracy in places like Burma, I guess to me the question is, how do you affect changes? Do you use the might of the U.S. military to affect changes, or and are willing to risk the attendant dangerous things that may happen of the numbers of people that will be killed in military operations? Right now we have it's almost 4,200 Americans that have been killed, and in estimates anywhere from 600,000 to 1.2 million Iraqis. That's a lot of people to be killed for something called democracy. Is there a better way to do it? Is there a way of pressure, continuing pressure, long-term pressure? I mean, I think we as Americans, we like to get things done fast. Let's get it done, get on, move on to something else. But when you're looking at the dangers, the challenges, the deaths that can occur by the use of military operations, sometimes it may be worth continued long-term pressure. You mentioned the country of Burma. Here was that huge cyclone that came through the international community really wanted to do a lot more assistance for the people of Burma that were homeless, and yet the generals that run the country refused to allow, at least for the first three weeks, refused to allow virtually any international aid in. Some people would say, well, that's when you should have just sent in the all U.S. military, take out that military, that Burmese military. But then what do you have? I've got a lot of questions on it too, just like you do, Randy. But I would say for Iraq that indeed the original rationale of the administration for going into Iraq was not democracy, but was weapons of mass destruction.
And I think a lot of people would echo Randy's thanks to you for standing up in the name of people who can't or won't. But I know that that's something that you have less tolerance for. You think that if people disagree with what's going on with the war or with anything the government's doing, they have an obligation. We have an obligation as Americans to actively do something about it.
Absolutely. I mean, we are one of the strongest countries in the world. We have a strong legal system. We have a heritage of people standing up against intolerance. I mean, you look at how America was formed. We do have a great history of people using civil disobedience for getting points across. And I hate to see our country kind of backsliding, where people may be so comfortable in their lives, their very affluent lives, compared to the rest of the world. The people in our own country, though, that may not be so affluent, that are really suffering under conditions of poverty. And all of us are suffering certainly right now with these increased prices on gasoline and food and everything. And what does America do in cases like that? Is there pressure that you can put on your own government to say, hey, maybe there needs to be a little governmental control on some of these profits that the oil companies? I mean, here we are in Texas, the home of some of the greatest oil companies in the world. I fully subscribe to the capitalist system where there is profit to be made, but I don't subscribe to enormous profits, the biggest profits in the history of the world, that are coming off the backs of the people of America that are suffering tremendously because of these high prices. And I think there is a role for governmental regulation of the amounts of profits that are made in times when extraordinary profits are out there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Phyllis in Dallas writes, who was the third diplomat to resign? And by the way, just what did Colin Powell say in his short note other than thanks for your service?
Well, that was just about it. It was thank you very much for your service, both in the military and in the diplomatic corps.
Do you think he read your letter?
Oh, yeah, I think he did. Mm-hmm. And I, from what I heard from other people that are still in the State Department, that the initial letter that was prepared by members of the staff was a little bit harsh and strident. It was pretty much like, well, you know, what an idiot you are that you aren't going along with these policies and, you know, good riddance almost. But that was not what Colin Powell wanted to say. And he simply wanted to acknowledge that I had served in government a long period of time and to wish me good luck. And that's essentially how it came out. My understanding was that he essentially dictated that tiny phrase to someone after he was very perturbed that he was not getting from the staff what he wanted.
And before we go into the break, the name of the third diplomat?
John Brown and Brady Keesling were the two others.
Great. Thank you so much. We will be back in just a minute with our discussion with Colonel Ann Wright. She's retired from the U.S. Army, and she resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service in 2003 in protest of the Iraq War and other Bush administration policies. Our telephone number, if you want to join us, is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright. She also served for 16 years in the U.S. Foreign Service. She's giving an address tonight for the Dallas Peace Center. It'll take place at 6 o'clock at Fun Asia in Richardson. You can find details at dallaspeacecenter.org. You can also read her book. It's called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. We'll go back to the phones now and speak to Arthur in Dallas. Hello, Arthur.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment and a quick question. During those hearings when Colonel Wright was arrested, it's amazing how the media who covered the hearings and the committee people completely dismissed the people that were yelling in the back as kooks and fringe. And Colonel Wright is anything but fringe or kooky. She's right on. And my question is, on a lighter note, when you get arrested all the time, is it the same unpleasant experience that anybody else does, where you're in jail for 12 hours waiting to be bailed out, or is there a mechanism in place that you get out pretty quickly, and what kind of legal fees do you have for this, and who's paying for them?
Well, it's a good question, and one of the questions that people do ask, too, is standing up in the congressional hearings, does that diminish your credibility as an Army officer and a former diplomat? I say it does not. I think it's very important that people who have been in government make public stands. I stay in the hooscow just as long as everybody else does. There's no special breaks given to diplomats or military officers. In fact, there may be when you tell some of the police officers that you were in the military, and many police officers have also been in the military, and they say, "Well, what were you? I was in the Army. What rank? Colonel." And they kind of go, "Oh, you know," and you think, "Oh, gripes. I hope they, if they were a sergeant or so, don't take it out on me as the colonel." But I have not had that experience. Although every now and then people do get roughed up by the police, unnecessarily roughed up. Legal fees are, you handle them yourself. Most of the time, there are some offenses that are payable by fines, and a lot of people say, "I don't want to pay a fine. I want to go to court. I want to have my day in court over it." Sometimes I go ahead and pay the fine because I do a lot of traveling and speaking all over the country, and I feel that's as valuable, or perhaps sometimes more valuable than being in court. Other times I do go to court. The last time I was in, this was for the Petraeus Crocker hearing, and I was fined and then put in jail for 3 days and had a 6-month period of probation that, should I have gotten arrested during that period, the judge had said that I would go back into jail and spend the rest of the 6 months. And I did not want to do that. I felt it was more important for me to be out speaking about the concerns that we have about the administration's policies.
Have you ever felt like the arrest, I mean, obviously civil disobedience means that you're doing something that legally you're not supposed to do. Have you ever felt like those arrests actually infringed on your right to free expression?
Indeed, and my right to travel. The FBI's National Crime Information Database is now being used to curtail the travel of some peace activists. Some of these misdemeanor violations have now been put on that National Crime Information Center database, which is now being used by the country of Canada. The Canadians, rather than using their own database of people who might be harmful, dangerous to their national security, somehow the Bush administration has twisted their arm to use the FBI's list. And on that are our violations of misdemeanors in the United States for peaceful nonviolent protest. The list is supposed to be for hardened criminals, for serious gangs, violent gangs, for parole violators, probation violators, for sex offenders. It doesn't really say anything at all about misdemeanors for sitting in front of the White House or protesting in Congress. And yet now the country of Canada has banned me from Canada.
The entire country. You can't enter Canada.
That's correct. Although I did get an exception to my expulsion one day last month when I had been invited to go up to speak at a war resisters conference in Vancouver. And the organizers of that conference arranged for a member of the Canadian Parliament to ride in the van with me from the state of Washington across the border. And also a film crew from the Canadian Broadcasting Company was in the van. And there was a news article that came out the day before we went across saying that we were going to be doing this. And we were kept for about 3 hours at the border crossing. And finally, the immigration officer said, "Well, we've contacted the immigration minister, and we will give you a 24-hour exemption to your expulsion order so you can go to that conference." But the expulsion order still stands. In fact, for it to get lifted, I have to be criminally rehabilitated.
It doesn't sound like there's much chance of that with your current line of work.
That's right. I have to have a clean, no arrests and convictions for 5 years, and all of the ones that are currently on the FBI's list that the Canadians use, I've got to send them all the court data, all of the arrest data. And what's so interesting is that jurisdictions are giving to the FBI merely arrests. It's not that you've been convicted of anything. They've just arrested you for something. And so that goes on to the database, and then the Canadians pull it up when you go through their immigration thing, and they use that to deny you entry. So it is of great concern to people that here Canada, the country that provided refuge to over 50,000 war resistors during the Vietnam War, is preventing peace activists from going, and now have deported one war resistor to this war. There are over 200 U.S. war resistors that are up in Canada who have applied for refugee status because the Canadians no longer have political asylum available to them. And they just last week deported the first U.S. war resistor who's now back in U.S. military custody in the United States. We were in front of the Canadian embassy last week doing a little demonstration in front of the Canadian representatives to the United States saying, you know, you should allow these war resistors to stay up there. You know, your history of Canada. Canada has not joined the coalition of the willing. Canada does not participate in the war in Iraq. And interestingly enough, they had a huge poster, probably 20 feet tall, a poster of Muhammad Ali in front of the embassy as a part of their art gallery program they had inside the embassy. And here you have one of the most famous U.S. war resistors of the Vietnam War, Muhammad Ali, in front of the Canadian embassy. And we were protesting the Canadians for having sent back a U.S. war resistor back to the United States, deported him.
Peace activist Anne Wright is my guest. Her number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hi. I just had a comment and a question. I talk to members of the active military on a regular basis, and I don't find any of them that agree with any of your guest's positions. And I'm just wondering how often she talks to active members of the military or Iraqis to get their perspective.
We'll get an answer. Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I think we all need to be talking to active duty of members of our military as well as our National Guard and reservists who are carrying a huge amount of the load of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And certainly there are a lot of military folks who say, we don't question the rationale of why we went in there. We were ordered to do it by the elected government of the United States, and our job is to follow orders. And what I believe personally doesn't come into play. And for a lot of people in any line of work, you know, when you have committed yourself to do something, you don't want to second guess yourself, and particularly on these issues of life and death, of where these men and women have seen friends of theirs that have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it really is difficult for them if they are questioning what's going on. There are plenty, though, that do. And in fact, there's a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. There are members of the active duty military who have signed what's called an appeal for redress, which is, I think, over 3,000 of them have now signed, which is appealing to Congress to relook what is going on in Iraq. And these are active duty people. I do speak to Iraqis that are traveling in the United States. I have not been to Iraq, but I speak to plenty of them that are coming into the United States. And there is a difference in opinion among Iraqis, too, about what's going on. Some Iraqis that come that are sponsored by the government of the United States travel here will probably be saying that they are glad the United States is there, that they appreciate what's going on. Then you have another group that will be coming over that say the United States needs to leave. And indeed, that's what the prime minister of the of Iraq is saying right now. Al-Maliki is now saying that there needs to be a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and that the presence of the United States, it needs to be reduced, according to Al-Maliki and lots and lots of Iraqis. But I acknowledge what David's saying, that there are people, both active duty, reservists, National Guard men and women who say, we've got our job to do, we follow orders, and they do it. And we have to appreciate that. And the main thing is when these men and women are coming back to our communities is to help them readjust to back into a community that really does not in any way look like we're a nation at war. And yet these men and women are coming back from extraordinarily stressful, tense times and just suddenly landing and they're in a country that really doesn't acknowledge the war's going on. So I think David and I would agree that we all need to be good friends and colleagues to these men and women and help them out during these difficult times of readjustment.
I think we have time for one more call, and that's Aziz in Colleyville. Hi, Aziz.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you. And you're one of the most admired women in my life, and I've watched your documentaries that have been made about you. I wish we had more of you in this country. The comment, the question that I have, we go and occupy nations and kill their people to impose democracy. And that's something the Soviet Union did. They invaded countries, occupied them, and killed their people to impose communism. And just like you said, almost 2 million people have been killed in Iraq between the wars and sanctions since 1991. So what is the difference between us and the former Soviet Union right now?
Well, thank you, Aziz. I would say that we as a country really need to look at our history, that indeed the way most of the rest of the world looks at America is not the same way that we look at ourselves, that we don't really acknowledge that we have been a part of the invasion and occupation of a lot of countries, that a lot of people have been killed during our occupations, and we of course will put the best face on it, that we always will come up with rationale of it's best for our own national security that some other country change its form of government, change its whatever. I'm not an apologist for Saddam Hussein by any means. I am glad that he's out of there, but the destruction that's happened to the country of Iraq by the method of going after him, I think will leave a legacy for the United States for a long period of time that will not be good. I think the image of the United States in most countries of the world now is pretty low, and we will have to do a lot of things to kind of get our stature back in the world. Continuing to invade and threaten and go to war has a limited life shelf, even for the strongest, the biggest military, strongest military in the world. I mean, of course, you can. We've got plenty of weapons that we can send to people that we don't like. But is that the way we really want to be seen? Is our national psyche a psyche of war? Or should we be thinking in different ways of how we can affect changes that will be beneficial for our own nation and for others, too, without killing people?
We only have about 30 seconds to go, but I'm wondering briefly what criteria you would set for rebuilding and repairing Iraq before we leave in large numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that we certainly there's the repair of Iraq, the rebuilding of Iraq is a responsibility of the United States. And the Iraqis can do it themselves, though. I mean, they rebuilt their country after the United States and coalition forces had bombed it during Gulf War I. They're perfectly capable of doing the actual construction. It doesn't have to be U.S. companies over there with enormous profit overheads to do that rebuilding. But one can say, well, the Iraqis have some oil money coming in too, and that can be thrown into it. But I think America does need to cough up quite a bit of dough for that one.
Retired Colonel Ann Wright will speak tonight at 6 at FunAsia in Richardson. The event is sponsored by the Dallas Peace Center. You can find them online at dallaspeacecenter.org. Her new book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience. And Ann, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.